Well, we started looking last week at how God is not holding out on us. He is naturally lavishing his goodness and his full presence. And we looked at the word gospel. Gospel is an ancient word that means good news. And we all know that there are people who bring joy and good news wherever they go. And there's also people who bring joy and good news whenever they leave. And God is the kind of being that we just want to be around him. He just brings good news. He really does. And today we're going to look at this word grace to a deeper degree. Grace being this idea of God just giving of himself when we haven't earned anything or we don't even deserve anything. Jesus talked about this, and there's a number of descriptive terms I'm going to use for grace today, or terms that some of them I learned in seminary, but they're really not in the Bible. They're just helpful handles. And this first one is a term that's come to be known as common grace. And Jesus says this in the book of Matthew chapter 5, verse 43. Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." Jesus says, everybody knows, no problem hating people who hate you, no problem loving people who love you, being nice to people who are nice to you, dissing people who diss you. But Jesus says, I'm saying I want you to go to a whole new level. I want you to love people who are against you. I want you to be nice to people who aren't nice to you. I want you to pray for your enemies, not just people who are nice to you. Because when you're like this, you're like God, who actually overflows with goodness to all people. There is this grace, this thing that nobody earns, that is common to everybody. It's as if we're in a big pool of grace, whether you're good, bad, evil, not evil, know God, don't know God, believe in Buddha, believe in Jesus, believe in Confucius, whatever it is, there's this common pool of grace in which you reside, where God causes things like the sun and rain that we all need, means of grace, modes of grace, good things to come on all of us, no matter who we are. This is who he is. He naturally overflows things. There's another term for grace that's come to be known as saving grace. This term saving grace, again, isn't in the Bible, but it's a common term that denotes another aspect of God where God actually enables us to not pay for our sins for all eternity. He actually pays for them by giving his son Jesus. The perfect God himself comes and takes human form and gets nailed to a cross. It's called saving grace. A number of years ago, I met and have kept up with a friend of mine, his name is Ken Blanchard, who's one of the best-selling business authors of all time. He wrote a book a number of years ago called The One-Minute Manager. And when he wrote that book, he really was in the midst of common grace, but he really didn't have a relationship with Jesus. And then later on, he came to receive Jesus, and an amazing thing happened in his life. And he looked back on how it was that he had the ability to write One-Minute Manager, which is really simple stuff, but yet made him scads of money. And then how he actually came to understand Jesus, and he told me this. I had to write it down. It's a pretty interesting thing. He said, "Man, when someone I received Jesus because grace was the best deal out there. Best deal out there. I don't have to do anything. I just receive. I don't have to earn anything. God just gives me love. Amazing. That's the best deal going." This idea of lavish love, we have to understand, this is entirely different than the way that you and I normally operate. We normally operate by, if I earn this, do this, then I get that. And so we naturally think of God, if I do this, don't do that, God will like me. I have to account for all of my badness. I have to earn my way out of it. And this is just is not right. It just isn't. There's a lot of us who we've forgotten things about God's nature, or there's things about God's nature we've never learned. I was thinking about this when I took recently a class on motorcycle safety. I did take one. Still haven't convinced me to wear a helmet, but nonetheless, it was a very, very, it was a very good class. And I was amazed, actually, as I sat in the midst of this class, the number of things that I did not know. I've been riding motorcycles off and on for a long time. And I did not know that as you're braking a motorcycle on a hard stop, all the weight transfer goes to the front tire. And instead of just putting on the brakes, you have to increasingly add more and more and more, clamping down on that front brake because that's where all your braking power is. Did not know that. The old myth was, don't put your front brake on because you'll flip over the handlebars. That's a stupid untruth. I knew that wasn't true, but I didn't understand how the forces work. There's other things that I knew that I'd actually forgotten. Oh, my goodness, that's right. I knew that. I used to do that. I don't do that any longer. That's the way it is with grace. It's so counter to the way we think, or God, that we need reacquainted with this. And I meet very few people who believe they have outages in understanding God. I mean, everyone just thinks that they get it completely. Whether you go to church, don't go to church, believe in this, don't believe. I mean, everybody feels like they get it, their views are right. No one feels like they have any gaps. I'm just having you open up your mind that perhaps you have some gaps here in your understanding of God and His grace. It's entirely different than the way that we normally function. The book of Romans chapter 4, verse 4 puts it this way. Now to anyone who works, their wages are not credited to them as a gift, but as an obligation. However, to anyone who does not work, but trusts God, who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. This says here that God does not want me to treat him as a person who gives me a paycheck. When I get a paycheck, it's because I've worked. I've hit a basic minimum requirement, and then I get a paycheck. This says, no, God's not obligated to me. He wants to operate with me according to grace. Not where I do certain things, and therefore I must get some of his goodness. No, he operates according to grace, not according to my works, not according to obligation. Now, if I wanted to play that system, he'll play that system with me. It's just that as soon as I make a mistake, I get hell. I don't want that system. I don't like that system. You know, God will operate in that system, and that means that every single time I do anything that's selfish, any single time I break the Ten Commandments, any single time I'm about my own esteem instead of God's esteem, any time when I'm about selfishness, racism, any time when I'm selfish, I mean, any time I do anything that Jesus wouldn't do, God could spank me right then. I don't want that system. I do not want the payback system. I don't want it at all. I want the grace system, which is totally opposed to the way most of us approach God and approach the rest of our life. Think of this whenever I go to court. Gone to court before for traffic violations, either for myself or one of my kids, two drivers, 18 or under. You know, you got to go do the traffic court thing. And whenever I've gone, I normally just don't pay the fine because then it's over. I don't want to get all the points for myself. I normally do this. I'll go. I'll set up a court date. And I'll come before the judge and say, how do you plead? And I'll tell the judge, I plead guilty. And they look at me like, you don't have to do this. You just send them money, check the little box. And I said, I plead guilty. I recognize that I was speeding, but I also know that you are a judge and you have the ability to offer grace and mercy. And I'm coming here asking for grace and mercy. And I just am asking you to give me grace and mercy, lower my fine, drop my points, whatever you see fit, and I'm okay with that. You laugh. I've done that all the time. I do it all the time. And whenever I do that, the judge always like, I haven't heard this before. The judge is not used to this at all. What they're used to is, here's my driving record that I've done. Look at all the good things I've done, and therefore, can't you give me some leniency here? Or to say, not guilty, and here's a little loophole. The cop doesn't show up, or the radar gun hadn't been tested for a while. They're used to that. They're not used to saying, yeah, I did it. I'm sorry, but I'm asking for grace and mercy. This is the posture that all spiritually great people take before God. I say, I know, I've done those things. I'm capable of all those things, but I want to operate in the mode of grace. I want to operate in the mode of you giving me things I haven't earned and I don't deserve. Now, as I said, there's this pool of grace that all of us sit in. All of us, our heart is beating right now, about 61 beats a minute or so. It's an example of grace. There's an electrical charge that is firing that you aren't working to do. You haven't invented. You aren't earning it. It's just the smallest example of grace. That electrical charge is going off, and you're living, and you're not doing anything to make that happen as an example. All of us are in these things. But at the same time, as I'm in that pool of grace, all of us are, there's also rain. There's places I can go. There's a direction I can go. When I see rain, say, I want more of God over there. I want more of grace. I want more of sensing God over there. Whenever I ride my bike out west, it's amazing how you can see storms way off in the distance. And normally you're seeing those and say, okay, we're not going to drive that way. We're going to go this way. But if I wanted to, I could track down moisture. I could track it down and I could drive to it. And this is the way it is with God. There are certain things we know about God that if you will go that direction, you'll get more of God. If you go that direction, there's more stuff that will naturally bubble over on God into you. Not if I go that way, God will give me a paycheck. He'll pay me back for my good things. But if I go there, that's where his fullness resides. Common grace exists in a strip club. It is. People's hearts are beating, and who knows what's happening there in strip club. we know many things are happening there at Strip Clubs, but you know, there's various things that are happening there that on numerous levels. But I'll tell you what, I don't come out of strip clubs. So I want to say when I go. Honestly, I don't come out of strip, and I don't go in them either. But if I were to go in and I were to come out, I don't feel more joy. I wouldn't feel more joy. I wouldn't feel more presence of God. It's just a place where, man, if you want more of God, there's other places to go. And similar, there's certain things that you can do, not to earn things, but if you go these directions, there will be more rain to fall on you, more connection with God, more understanding. So I'm going to talk about those things. I'm about five handles of grace today. These are unofficial terms, but these are handles to help you understand grace and things to trend your life to. I just got done reading a section of the Bible. I'm reading through the Bible again this year. And there's six books in the Old Testament, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, that tell the history of the nation of Israel while they were coming under the rule of kings and all that happened over generations after generations. And it's amazing how in the Old Testament, this seemingly God of the Old Testament, who people think always have a bad attitude, showers grace over and over and over and over again. So it starts when there's a guy by the name of Samuel who is a prophet, part of the governing system, the high governing system of the nation of Israel that God has established. And the people come to Samuel, the prophet, and say, Samuel, we're seeing all these other nations around us have kings. We feel left out. We want a king. We don't want you and that system of government. We want an actual king. So Samuel goes to God, and here's how the conversation goes in 1 Samuel. He says this. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. They're losers. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, listen to all the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king, as they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. We've been learning around here. We did a free journey a couple months ago and learned there's a lot of us feel rejected, feel like people are out to get us or feel like we were abandoned. So we'll perceive that if we don't get the promotion, it's not just that somebody was more qualified, but somebody's rejecting us. They're against us. We're paranoid. We don't feel like people are for us. It's a very natural condition around here. And seemingly, Samuel has the exact same thing. They've rejected me. I feel like they don't honor the job I'm doing. They're telling me I'm a loser. He is not in a good place right now. And God says, Samuel, you think you feel rejected? I'm the one who feels rejected. I'm the one who feels abandoned. It's not you. I set up this system and they don't like it. This is amazing about God. We see that he feels here. He feels. He feels slighted. He's bruised here with this. He personally feels rejected. Now, when I feel rejected by somebody else, I want to power up on them. And you should be very thankful that I'm not God, you know, because if you ever rejected me and I was God, I would just pound you into applesauce. I'm sorry. You would be put into your place. I would have all authority and power, and I would make it right. Thankfully, God isn't like me, because when he's rejected, he has grace that gives him the ability to be patient. So he goes back to Samuel and says, hey, go to people, tell them, hey, if there's a king, he's gonna tax you for his wars, he's gonna draft your sons into his army, he's gonna have all these possessions. This is not gonna be a good deal for them. Samuel goes back to the people, says, this is the way it's gonna happen. You don't want this. And the people say, no, you know, we really do want this. Give us a king. And check out what happens. It says this, the Lord answered, listen to them, give them a king. This is amazing. And he doesn't say, oh, go ahead, give him a king, but I don't like it, and I'm gonna make sure it doesn't work out for him. He says, all right, I'll accommodate that. This is the grace of accommodation. It's a handle to understand where God is. The grace of accommodation. It is amazing that God accommodates. This is not a God that I learned in Sunday school. I did not learn of a God that would accommodate people out of love. I learned of a God that was rigid and would just spank you and put you in line if you ever got out of step. He would never accommodate. It's a God who accommodates. His values, he never changes. In his essence, he stays the same. But only the strong have the ability to accommodate. You all know weak people. Weak people never accommodate. They have to get their way, dig their heels in, or they can't play with you. They can't have a relationship. But God is strong love. He accommodates. There's the grace of accommodating. You know, this is good news. Because when you and I screw up, it doesn't mean that our life is over. God says, I can still work with that. I can accommodate that. I can work with that. It's beautiful. Like, I don't earn it. I don't deserve it. But God accommodates it. The grace of accommodation. Now the next, the first king in Israel's history is Saul. He starts out really well, and then he starts going downhill fast, really, really fast. And so the second king that comes up is a guy by the name of David. And God's grace comes to him. He never works for this. He's the youngest son of the household of Jesse, which was totally contrary to the way society operated, because the way that society would operate is the oldest son, the one who would work the hardest, the one who was strongest, the one who had earned it would become king. But instead, God's grace, you can't figure it out. It isn't a paycheck. It's not tit for tat. It's also unequal. We all get different amounts of things, but though we all get amazing numbers of things that we haven't earned, God's grace rests on this young shepherd boy, David, and says he's the one. David is groomed to be king. He becomes a great warrior in Israel's army. He becomes a great king in waiting. He becomes a great warrior king and becomes an amazing, amazing king. And as he gets the pinnacle of his power, at a time when he's supposed to be out defending the borders of the country, he stays back in the nation of Israel, stays back in Jerusalem, and he has the ability to see a beautiful woman on the top of a building. And he lusts for her, he has adultery with her, and he tries to cover it up by murdering in the first degree her husband so he never gets caught. And he's become hardened to God, he's oblivious to this, and Nathan comes to him, his friend, who's a prophet, who understands what God wants. Nathan comes and calls him to the carpet on the things that he's done to dishonor God and actually dishonor all of Israel. And check out this conversation, it says this. Nathan said to David, you are the man. You're the one who's done wrong. And this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you. I gave your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if all this had been too little, goes on. It says, hey, look, I've done all this stuff for you, man. I've given you amazing powers of leadership. I've given you amazing spoils. I've given you amazing possessions. I've given you amazing sex life. I've given you all these amazing, just kind of flowed over on you. And if all has been too little, now I think, if all has been too little, then you should just understand, tough toenails, you had enough. I thought that's what God would say. Or if all this has been too little, then you got a major perspective problem, pal. I don't understand what you think. You need more. That's what I'm thinking God would say. But instead, look what God says. He said, if all this has been too little, I would have given you even more. What? God's not setting him up for the punch, and so there you're a loser. He sets him up and says, hey, man, and this was just the beginning of my goodness that could overflow on you. If that had been too little, I would have given you even more. More experiences, more understandings of myself, more, I mean, amazing things here. What we see here is there is a grace of abundance. God is not a miserly being who doles out his pennies in equality and gives you just enough to get by the next day. He has way more resources at his disposal than you and I can ever imagine. And why some get more than others, or why I don't have more than I would like to have, I don't understand all of this, but I understand we all are receiving way more stuff than we've ever earned from God, and God has way more stuff to give than you can ever imagine. And I'm not talking here just material stuff, because that's the way wacky televangelists with white belts talk about this stuff. I'm not talking about Mercedes. I'm talking about all kinds of things. There is no shortage to God's resources that just overflow and lavish on us. Entirely different system in the Bible than any other religious system, entirely. I was thinking about this when I was over in India. I really got a tutorial on karma. I thought I knew what karma was. I didn't really understand the fullness of what karma is. We joke about karma or use it as a slang term today. We all talk about karma, this or that, and I've heard people crossroads talk about their parking karma. You know, they have good parking, can find a good slot, or they don't, and you know, we all use that word in various ways, but really, it's different in the Hindu system in India. Karma is tied to the caste system, which means your previous life, you are born into a specific caste, and that is your slot in life that you work on. And you ain't going nowhere. the cast, your karma is you is who you is, you are who you are. There is no more coming your way. There is nothing you can do at all. You are slotted there. No improvements to your life, no more stuff coming. You're just there. And that's part of why there's not a lot of humanitarian aid in Hindu cultures, because you don't humanitarian help people in lower caste because they got to work off their stuff. It's on them. They got to work. You're not going to give them grace or help or love. They got to work off their stuff. They have no hope of anything different in this life in the Hindu idea of karma. Entirely opposed the idea of abundance. There are new places, new things that can come your way. God said, man, it just overflows for me. Where you are right now is not where you're going to end up. Run to the rain. Don't just stay where you are, go, woe is me. Run to the rain. Wherever you see God, wherever you sense his presence, wherever you sense what pleases him, trend your life over that way. And what does this include? This also includes work. There's the grace of work. The grace of work. But look at this different twist on work as we see in the book of 1 Corinthians in the New Testament portion of the Bible. Here's what it says. It says this: by the grace of God, I am what I am. This is Popeye speaking here right now. I am what, no, it's not Popeye. It's a guy by the name of Paul who was an early leader in the Christian church. He said, by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace to me was not without effect. It affected me. Man, when God bubbled over, that's grace touched me deeply. No, I worked harder than all of them. I worked, yet not I, but the grace of God that was in me. We saw in the 7 days of creation, what did God do? He worked. He got a freaking job and he worked. 6 days he worked. And so what do? I pattern my life after God and I want to work. There is a grace of work that when I work, I am encountering God's presence. I'm encountering him in me. I'm not working in order to get God's presence. I'm not working in order to earn God's goodness. It's that when I work, I know there's an area there where there's rain. And when I go and labor in any way that's honoring to him, honoring to get a paycheck, to pay my family, to support my family, to do things responsibly, honoring and working to serve those who are in need, I'm in a position where moisture of God's going to be coming on me. How many of us were at Go Cincinnati yesterday? Come on, give me a break. About 500 people were at our Mason site getting a little rah-rah before they went out and served 400 different projects all over the city, 40, 50 different churches. 500 folks met up at Mason to get ready. Here at Crossroads, the people who just met here was about 3,800 people right here for our rah-rah time. Someone grabbed the camera on the stage. Check out what this building here looked like right before we went out and served. Check it out.
If you guys don't mind, I just ask that you guys give a shout out to my guy.
Oh my goodness, it was like liquid love. Everywhere I went, it was like breathing in this amazing grace. It was everywhere. Why? Because where God is when people come together, join together as a team, and do the things that Jesus would do. And whenever that happens, there is an amazing grace that's present. I put it on my calendar every year. I look at my preaching schedule, and I could have been on a bike trip this weekend, but I said, no, I'm not going to do this weekend because Go Cincinnati's on there because I want more of God's grace. And every time it's on Go Cincinnati that weekend, every single time, I know I'm going to feel the benefits of it. It's a standard thing. I want to go that direction. My family and I, we went to our project. It was over in the west side. Never heard this place before. It's called, I think it was House of Eve, and amazing vision, big house. And these folks do is they take women who are homeless or women who are incarcerated or just getting out of jail. They reunite them with their small children, and they live in this house. And then what they do, or what we were doing, is tilling ground to create a huge, massive garden. There was 50 people that descended on this place, doing all kinds of imaginal things. And the vision was to get big crops going so that the women could feed themselves and their children and then take it to a farmer's market and learn business skills, learn inventory, learn pricing structure, learn balancing books, which would give them then some sense of business skills to make themselves more marketable. And I'm hearing this, honestly, I'm a star kid. My eyes just start tearing up. I go, you gotta be freaking kidding me. Are you serious? And put me to work. And 50 people just descended on this place, mulching and tilling and weeding. I'm telling you, it was grace like rain falling there. I was feeling God's presence everywhere I went. And why do you feel good when you're at Go Cincinnati? Why is that? You feel good because you're feeling the grace of God. And why do you feel good when you go to a job that, quite frankly, is a drain for you? But yet, why do you feel good? You feel good because you know that you're still honoring God and providing a living for yourself and your loved ones. There is a grace of work. Not I work to earn God's favor, not I work to earn God's approval, but this is an activity that when I go there, I'm more apt to sense God's goodness overflowing on me. Now, another part of David's life when he was really on his game, on his spiritual game, was when he had the opportunity to offer a burnt sacrifice to God. In ancient cultures, ancient religions, you would take an animal and you would burn it on an altar signifying to God, I'm giving this to you, I'm offering this up to you. And also in the Old Testament, this is also signifying, God, I'm the one who should be burned. You're reminding me of your grace that this animal is taking the pain when I really should be taking the pain. And of course, the grace we talked about last week is that Jesus, the Lamb of God, took the pain. There's a lot of tapestry of meanings and truth that's woven throughout this whole thing, all tying back to the lavish grace of God. And David is going to offer up a sacrifice, and the place where this altar is, the guy who owns the land says, oh, David, I've heard of you. You have a great reputation. Let me just give you the animal to give here. And here's how David responds. He says this, no, I insist on paying you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing. He says, no, I'm not going to go the cheap way out here. There is a kind of grace that comes when there is a sacrifice. I'm not going to offer something that costs me nothing. This is what I'm going to call the grace of giving. There is a grace, a presence that comes when you give. This is not the way, again, our society operates. We think the good stuff happens when I save, and I only give so I get a tax write-off, or I get that annoying person off my back. That's not the way it works. There's a grace that comes when I give. I'm going to tell you, regularly, yesterday I go to Cincinnati, and all the time I pinch myself for being here at Crossroads and having my job being a pastor, to be a pastor here and a leader. I pinch myself and go, is this me? Am I here? Why do I have this job? How can I do this amazing thing and Crossroads also be very generous to me and my family? This is. Let me tell you something. I know a lot of men and women who are more godly than I am. Really, they are. I don't know if you know that or not. There are many people who are more like God than I am, more moral than I am, who know the Bible way better than I do, who have more Bible verses memorized than I do, who have much longer and deeper prayer lives than I do, who have fewer vices than I do, and actually who speak better than I do. Yeah, really, you wouldn't know that by my diction. And yet I'm here. Why is it? It's a part of the grace of God that I get to do this where other folks labor in situations that are just hard. And I'll also tell you some of the reasons, my belief, not just the grace of God that I have not anything to earn, but there's been decisions Libby and I made long, long time ago where we wanted to head towards the rain. One of them was in our giving. I remember we had $26,000 of a household income. We had family of three, and we always wanted to have this principle, this idea of a tithe, 10% just going right to God, costing us something. And I remember people I was in ministry with who were about the same economic level said, man, the tithe thing, well, that's not for people like you. That's not like for people like you and me. I said, what do you mean by that? Well, that's for people who are in the business world and people who make a lot more money than us. We do this thing called grace giving. I said, what's grace giving? I said, well, it means you just give whatever you would like to give. I was like, oh, interesting. My Bible doesn't say that. That's fascinating. Interesting. And I said, no, we're not going to go that path. And I'll tell you what, it was hard. It is hard as a starting percent. That was a starting percent a long time ago for that. And I'm telling you what, remember major sacrifices we've made, things have been changed. There's no question in my mind. As I look at some of the people who counsel me on that, I would not want their life right now. I'm not saying it's payback. I'm saying this. I'm saying I and Libby went to the rain. It is crazy if you want the grace of God that you're more concerned about your saving number than your giving number. There's a problem. There's a major, major problem. You're going the way of the normal world, not the way of God, the way of grace. I'm telling you, until you come to a point where you see that God is a giver, he's not a saver. I have some savings, but he's a giver, not a savings. He didn't save himself. He gave himself. He gave his son, the sacrifice of lamb, on a cross. He generously, lavishly poured him out. And I say, if I want some of that action, if I want to have that kind of abundance on me, I need to trend towards that rain. It's the grace of giving. Now, one person likes that. Good. Okay, good. Now, it's just one of the handles. There's all kinds of different handles to this. I'm just giving you five of these handles of ways to think and trend toward where if you get to these places, you're more apt to sense grace in and through your life. And this final one is that I'm going to share today is comes from the third king in Israel's history. Again, this is, I'm specifically and strategically using a lot of Old Testament references here to see that there's not some ornery, rigid God in the Old Testament that's tit for tat, like many of us have been deluded into thinking. There is an overflowing, abundant, lavish God from start to finish through the Bible. And this third one, name is Samuel. And Samuel is where problems really start to come along. David obviously had major problems. But when David has problems, he says, dude, I'm sorry, God, I'm running back to the rain. I'm repenting. I'm running. That's another way to say running to the rain. I'm repenting. I'm changing direction. I'm running back to the rain. But Solomon, the third one, he never really does that. He just kind of goes his own way, has a lot of good things happen in his life, makes some really good calls, makes some really bad calls. But we don't see the level of introspection in him that you like to see with the king of his stature. But sometimes he's really on his game and God approves. Here's one of them. In the book of 2 Kings, says this. So Solomon observed the festival at that time, and all Israel with him, a vast assembly, people from Lebo Hamath to the Wadi of Egypt, they celebrated it before the Lord our God for 7 days and 7 days more. 14 days in all. This is a festival. It's one of the festivals that God would mandate in the Bible. Samuel says, you know what? We're going to do it longer than 7 days. We're going to double it. 14 days, party hardy, everybody shut down your businesses, bring your fermented drink, bring your oxen, bring your popcorn, your Cheetos. We're just going to party without a karaoke machine for 14 days. This seems like a lavish display of rest. How can this be? Because God is not about us working. God is not about us just sacrificing. God is not just about us going through pain and gyrations to earn his approval and satisfy his wrath. He said, no, you get it all. I want all of it. There is such a thing as the grace of rest. When I feel guilty because I'm resting, I am not where God is. We feel guilty when we rest. We feel guilty if we can't look at everything checked on a to-do list on a specific day. We feel guilty about this. We feel like I've been unproductive because this is what society tells us. Always be productive. And we transfer this to God, and we think that God is always telling us to always be productive, always go forward. That's why God just sets up these festivals, said, no, I'm going to force you to just chill and rest and vacation and connect with me and just sense more of me. That's what I want. This is the grace of rest. I think it's interesting that, as I said earlier, God works. We see that in the creation story, God works. On the sixth day, God creates human beings. In the first day of their life, the seventh day, they have to rest. On the seventh day, it says, God rested. And so human beings who are put here to work, put here to take care of the planet, name animals, right out of the gate, God says, okay, hurry up and take a break right now. Time for you to take a break. Woo! Adam and Eve, man, it's all been a hard run already. Take a break. What he's doing, he's cueing us in. We're not here to be productivity machines. We're not here to justify the reason for our existence. We are here to sense and appreciate God. And I've got to work to experience that. I've got to celebrate. I've got to give. I've got to sense and drink into a bottle. There's a bunch of handles. I got to remember that God is not about me being a machine. He wants me to rest. There's the grace of rest. Run to this rain, friends. I'm telling you. Find the things that Jesus does, that God likes, and trend your life to it. Last verse for today, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 to 10. It encapsulates a lot of this in this little soundbite here. It says this. For it is by grace you've been saved through faith, not of yourselves. It's the gift of God. It's not you've been saved through your works. This is your doing. No, no. You've been saved through faith. It's not from yourselves. It's not of your own figuring out in your mind. It's not of your own works. It's not of your own pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. It is the gift of God. It's his lavish display of his generosity. And it's not by works. It's not by anything you could do so that no one can boast, so that no one can take pride in themselves. We are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. You know what this says? It says that God has created me for doing good things. And actually, he's prepared them for me. He's set them up on display, saying, this one, go do this one. And why do I do this one? I do this one in large part because he's prepared this work for me. And when I do work, I sense his presence. There's a grace, a unique grace that falls on me. Whether it's the work of earning a living, whether it's the work of serving the poor, whether it's the work of resting. It is a work to rest. That's why many of us don't rest. Whether it's the work of living in an abundant expectation, there's a great God, or it's the work of being able to accommodate other people. We're going to have a whole message on that. How do you accommodate other people? The grace of accommodation. Now, this last song we're going to sing right now is another ancient song. Just stand up right now. Let me tell you about this song. Old song called Amazing Grace. And by the way, before I tell you about this, let me tell you about another grace. There's hundreds of them. Here's another one. There's such a thing as the grace of suffering. Yeah, the televangelist won't tell you about that one. It's true. The grace of suffering. There are some of us in here right now, you are suffering deeply right now. It doesn't feel like God's lavish on you at all. You got a bad doctor's report, still out of work. Your significant other left you. You've got, there's something going on. You lost a child. Lost a child, you know. There's a suffering. And the Bible also says, unto you it has been granted to suffer. It's actually a grace. It doesn't feel like in the moment, but when I suffer, if I'm suffering for the right things, I'm actually aligning myself with Jesus who suffered. I'm aligning myself with a God who actually lost a child. That's part of his lavishness. It's one of the things I'm not sure that I like, but it does something to me. God is never holding out on you. One man who suffered was the man who wrote this song called Amazing Grace. His name is John Newton. He was a slave trader. He was a slave trader in England. And he suffered under amazing remorse for the things that he had done to human beings. Going over to another country in kidnapping people, bring them over and having them be forced labor that would prop up the economy. Then John Newton really linked up with William Wilberforce. John Newton received saving grace from God, turned his life around, and he became a pastor. And he linked up with William Wilberforce to help end the slave trade in England, which then set a precedent and trickled down to America. And he wrote this song about the saving grace, the experience that made no sense to him because nobody should be in God's good graces given what this guy had done. And he wrestled with this. He suffered with this. And it's believed that he actually gave these words to an original tune. This is a reprised tune we're doing, but the original tune, in all likelihood, was a tune that was being sung in an ancient African tongue in the belly of his ship that he didn't understand the words to, but that chorus haunted him and he put words to it talking about the amazing grace of God. God, you are amazing, and we sing this to you, and I'm just wanting us to get to the rain, and I'm thanking you for bringing the rain.